Okay. So night two of this spring series of rambles. Sounds very attractive. We're exploring the theme of the Dhamma transforming society. Yesterday I talked about the way in which the Dhamma has the possibility not only transforming ourselves, but of transforming the world around us. And we explored what makes that possible. The potentialities within reality that the Dhamma accentuates and uses to change ourselves, change the world around us. We talked about those in terms of two conditioned processes. Everything, according to the Buddha, arises in dependence on conditions. Those conditions work according to various kinds of regularity. It's the sort of thing we're familiar with from science. Chemical laws, physical laws, mechanical laws, organic laws. But according to Buddhism, according to the Buddha, there are two kinds of conditioned process that are key to our development as human beings and even to our happiness and fulfillment, and that are also the powers that can transform the world around us. And this is first of all the potentiality of karma. Karma, very briefly, I talked about it yesterday, so I'm just recapitulating briefly, is those laws that govern the effect that our self-conscious willing, our self-conscious volitions have internally and externally. If we are motivated by skillful motivations, that is by feelings of harmony, feelings of even love, you could say, feelings of well-wishing, if we're motivated by generosity, by an openness, if we're motivated by awareness, genuine awareness of what is going on around us, there's a modification, of course, in our behaviour. That behaviour affects the world around us, but especially the law of karma looks at the way in which that changes us, our own experience. The way in which our own minds arise in a richer, a fuller, a more satisfied, more fulfilled, and more integral way. A way that's more interactive with the world around us, so that we're more at peace with the world around us, more in harmony with the world around us. Buddhist development is initially a development based on karma. Those of you who have been coming here and done meditation will be activating karma in that way. When you especially do metta bhavana, you're developing skillful motivation. You're developing well-wishing towards others. And of course it's not always immediately successful. Sometimes it takes some time to feel some result. But you will experience a change in your own inner feeling. You will feel at times when you do the metta bhavana, you will feel more in tune. You'll feel happier. You'll feel brighter. You'll feel more able to see things clearly. It's very difficult for us to see clearly when we're in the grip of negative emotion. But when you're experiencing maitri, metta, loving kindness, you feel more easily able to take what's really there in. So there's an evolution of our own minds, our own consciousness, under the influence of or in accordance with these laws of karma, which is just as objective, just as much part of the way things are as the law of gravity is, as photosynthesis is. These are, as it were, built in, by which I do not wish to imply that anybody put them there. That's just the way things are. It works that way. if you have skillful mental states, there will be a modification of your own mind. Your mind will grow. And of course, you will interact with the world around you in a smoother, more harmonious, more constructive way, more creative way. And as you practice developing skillful karma, karma means action, action of body, speech and mind, as you work to develop skillful karma, your mind will grow, you will grow as an individual. And what you'll find happening is that you feel less and less isolated, you feel less and less separate from everything around you, you feel more in tune with other people. And not just with people like you, so to speak, not just with people who suit you. You'll feel more in tune with humanity. Not just with humanity, with everything that lives, even with animals, with the natural vegetable world, as it were. You'll feel more part of it all and interactive with it all, that your own mind is not separate from it. According to Buddha's teaching, a point is reached in that development that the barriers break down altogether. They just go. You no longer base yourself upon a strong feeling of separate I. You no longer base yourself so much on a desire to protect, to defend, to aggrandize I. It's not that you disappear, but the whole motivation alters. It sort of turns inside out. This is what the tradition tells us. And a point is reached where the motivations change from self-rooted motivations to motivations that are compassionate, that are generous in an entirely spontaneous way, and which are completely and increasingly in tune with the reality of things, the way things really are. So karma processes that are developed through a willed effort to cultivate skillful motivation, which is what we do when we meditate. We deliberately try to develop skillful motivation, we try to develop well-wishing towards others, we make an effort to do that. At a certain point, and it's not necessarily that distant a point, periods of time will come when we are free from self-centeredness, maybe momentarily, maybe even for an hour or two, maybe even for days on end. You can have whole periods when you feel as if you're acting, but without any selfish self-reference. Of course, something may be there, but the fundamental drive comes from beyond ego, to put it that way. And again, this is all sort of put in cold conceptual terms, but the experience is one that probably everybody's had to some extent. Points, moments, when at least to a little degree you get rid of the constant reference back to I. Moments of generosity, particularly moments of spontaneous generosity. Moments when you just find yourself doing something to help somebody else, perhaps without even thinking about it. May regret it later, of course, but in the act it comes quite spontaneously. Moments when you just feel, maybe, you know, the sort of thing that happens to you unawares, sitting on the tube of all places. You're sitting there and you have that uncomfortable London Underground feeling of slightly defending yourself, your space. I was sitting next to somebody this afternoon who sort of took up 1.5 spaces, very large, and I caught myself resenting him. And then he suddenly turned to the person sitting opposite and said, I don't know what it was, but it was something along the lines of, who are you staring at? And, you know, the whole situation became rather jagged. And that's very often one's experience in that situation, is of defending our eye, because you're with a whole bunch of strangers. And we're not sort of built for that, really. The underground is a thoroughly unnatural place. Sort of seriously, in a way. But I don't know, maybe just me. I don't think so. So points suddenly come in that kind of situation where you don't feel that sort of separation. You don't feel that barrier. You feel everybody moving with the train. And you sort of sense that, well, for a start, you may just sense everybody else is in this strange state of slight alienation and isolation. And for a little while you feel free of it. Well, you know what I'm talking about. So sort of moments like that strike you in a quite ordinary way. They don't seem very grand. Many, many different kinds of situation. You can just suddenly feel a little bit free from your self-obsession, your self-preoccupation, and the drive to build things around yourself, for yourself. In a very, very gratifying, very pleasurable feeling. According to Buddhism, this is really what we're trying to develop. This is the state of mind that our whole Buddhist activity is directed towards. It's achieving a state of mind where you are not simply driven by self-interest. Of course, self-interest is there for a long time, even to the verge of enlightenment. But increasingly, a sense of the transcendence of self is there. It's a quite ordinary, everyday state of mind. It's not, you know, bells and whistles. It's not brightly coloured glows and all that. It's just an ordinary sense of going beyond yourself. That, according to tradition, as you develop karmically, naturally begins to arise. You begin to feel more and more in tune. And in Buddhist practice, you deliberately work to bring that about. You introduce an element of reflection, an element of practice that allows that increasingly to come into play. For instance, you deliberately undertake altruistic activity. Even if it's a little bit sort of forced, you do it just because it breaks that down in you. You try to make contact with people you wouldn't normally make contact with, deliberately, in order to break down the isolation. You deliberately reflect on the presuppositions that you bring to life, the presuppositions that we are ultimately separate, that we are a fixed identity. You begin to question notions of fixity, notions of separateness, and you try to gain, first of all, an intellectual recognition of the limitations of those conceptions, those assumptions, but then a deepening sense of conviction that they are wrong, and that the truth is much more fluid, much more interactive, conditioned. And these processes begin increasingly to take over from the karma processes. And in tradition, they're known as dharma processes. So they're states of mind that arise, independence upon your karmic development. They're states of mind that arise, which are motivated by, well, you could say, compassion. They're motivated by a spontaneous, non-self-referential concern with the welfare of others. When we're doing the Maitri Bhavana, the Metta Bhavana, we're deliberately trying to cultivate those states at the level of karma. But if you develop them for long enough at the level of karma, they become dharmic. They begin to act spontaneously within you. And according to tradition, what happens to you is you enter the stream of the dharma. You enter a stream of mental states that are dharmic, that are based upon, well, not I. They're based upon simply a sense of interaction, a sense of concern for the life all around you. That's what really we're trying to do here. That's fundamentally what this place is about. We're more or less successful, but that's what we're trying to do, try to change the whole character of our consciousness. So it's these two processes, you could almost say forces, in the sense that gravity is a force, if you see what I mean. We're trying to activate these two forces in our own lives so that they transform us. But we're trying to activate them in society. It's these processes, these forces that are the Dhamma transforming society. And it's these forces, when they're unleashed from individuals, especially individuals in community, that society changes for the better. So this is my reference point, these two forces, this sort of metaphysical background, which is actually simply a description of real experience. It's not something merely conceptual, it's something that you can experience from fairly early on. You can experience both those. You'll especially experience karma at work, but you'll from time to time just have some sort of sense of lifting beyond it all. Then it'll go, and then you grind away at karma. But the more you do this, the easier it becomes. So, how do we do this? Or rather, how do we focus on the transformation of society? Interestingly enough, I'm coming to this point in the discussion, having just been to the House of Lords. I've walked in the corridors of power, thickly carpeted and richly decorated. A group of us went down to, at the invitation of a friendly lord, and had a look around. I don't think much is going to change as a result of our visit. I don't want anybody to overestimate our power yet. Well, interestingly, in a way, you could sort of see that if one could build relationships with people like the noble lord we visited, something could come across, something could influence. But anyway, it's quite interesting, just having a glimpse of this well-oiled, very well-run, very pleasant, actually. It was an extremely positive sort of atmosphere there. The place where there's a little bit of power. I'm afraid in Britain there's not much anymore there, but still, give a little taste of Buddhism coming into interaction with power. But I don't think that's where I want to start. There are three areas I want to talk about, which seem to me the main areas where we can focus our attention in trying to bring karma and dharma processes to bear on society. You might cut the cake a different way. These are ways that I've thought about things from my own experience, but you could think about it another way. So I want to talk about bringing the Dhamma to bear on the lives of people who are excluded, oppressed, in poverty, and to some extent powerless. I think that's the first area that I feel drawn to bring the Dhamma to bear upon. But because in a way so many people have a fairly comfortable life, certainly in Britain, but you see in the world at large, and even in Britain too, you see people who really suffer very acutely from a socially oppressive system, an economically oppressive system, and a background of ideas that are, well, in the end, you could almost say evil. Or at least it's that casual evil that's the worst of evils, if you know what I mean. We're decent people in every other respect who are kind to dogs and their families, treat other people as inhuman, non-human. You know, if you saw Downfall, Hitler was kind to his dog and his secretary. So, yes, that's the first place I want to start. I'm then going to talk a bit more about the way in which the Dharma needs to be brought to bear on society at large, on the attitudes and ideas that generally support the situation that we have around us. There are fundamental perspectives that are broadly shared in society that create the social system that we have and the economic system that we have, that keep it in being. And Buddhism has something to say about the meaning of human life, what human relations could be, which could have a big effect upon society at large for the better. So that's my second area. My third area is the influence that the Dhamma can have on those who sense that a conventional life is not enough. Probably you generally are represented by that category. People who, you know, maybe even fairly successful, maybe even fairly happy in a certain sort of way, but you kind of sense that this isn't all we're here for. There must be more to it. If it is all there is to it, well, it's pretty hopeless. If it's just eat, drink, retire, die, I think I might check out now. It just doesn't seem worth it. You know, pleasurable as it can be. Also quite a lot of struggle and pain, and it just doesn't seem worth it. I've had a pretty happy life, a pretty easy life. I came from a privileged background. But still, I think I'd say in the end, I'm not sure what the point is if it's just about, you know, living and dying. If it's just, I live in Wales in the middle of a sheep field. If it's just a human sheep, I'm not sure it's worth it. So there are quite a lot of people who feel that. And the Dhamma can say something to them. And that has an implication not just for them, but for society as a whole. So I'll try and string all this together. Let's start, as I say, with the most obvious need, where it's very, very plain that there are people who desperately need help because they suffer from active exclusion, active oppression, active prejudice. Of course, that happens in this country too, but you see it on gigantic scales in many parts of the world. And I think that if you're doing the Metta Bhavana every day, if you're doing it even once a week, if you just do it occasionally, you can't ignore the active suffering that there is around here and elsewhere. We're also acutely aware of the news these days, and to turn on the news is to be deluged by suffering. So, yes, there are people who suffer from systemic exclusion, oppression, and so forth. And the Dhamma can dramatically change their lives. I'm starting here because this is somewhere where we've got direct evidence of the power of the Dhamma to change society. You're probably, all of you, aware of the caste system in India. But India's social system is based on graded inequality according to birth. It's like class, only, you know, 100 times more impacted. It's like a racial discrimination, but far more complex, far more enclosed, because it's so segmented. It's a very complex system. It's said to be the oldest and most successful system of social hierarchy and, well, not to put too fine a point upon it, oppression. And in 1956, beginning with some 500,000 or so of these people, and now something like 30 million of them have become Buddhists. They became Buddhists under the inspiration of a very great leader who came from their community, who became a great political figure in India, and in fact wrote the constitution of the independent India, which is a nice irony. Somebody from the so-called untouchable community wrote the constitution of independent India, under which India still operates. Democratic India still operates. A very nice irony, not lost upon his followers. And he decided to convert to Buddhism because he had exhausted all other possibilities. He'd got a very good education himself in Britain and in America, went back to India, a highly qualified man, expecting that just modernity, so to speak, would mean that he was free and that slowly others in his community would follow him. But he experienced immediately systemic prejudice. Famously, he worked as a high civil servant in a princely state, and his peons, which means that the messengers, whose responsibility was to bring files to him, would stand at the door of his office and throw the files onto his desk because they didn't want to come too close because that would pollute them. And this is the nature of casteism in that way. So he recognised the intractable and deeply embedded nature of casteism. He started a struggle which had a political dimension, very strong political dimension. He formed a political party. He engaged in labour agitation. He led strikes against oppressive mill owners in Bombay, which were successful in the end. He entered government at the invitation of the British Viceroy as the Labour member, and he wrote the basis for Labour laws in India even today. So he'd struggled to change the system in many different ways. When India became independent and the independent state of India was established in 1947, he was inducted into the first cabinet by Nehru. It seems under the suggestion of Lord Mountbatten, who was at that time the governor, he became the law minister, and as I told you, he was involved in writing the constitution. He was the chairman of the drafting committee, and it said had the major hand in it. He, as law minister, he began to revise Indian law to bring it into harmony with democratic and liberal principles. And especially he tried to reform Hindu family law, which assigned no rights, no property rights to women, or a very limited property rights to women, still treated women as essentially the property of the husband. The British had left undisturbed the customary laws of the different communities. So Dr. Ambedkar just sort of went about the business of creating a framework of law which would be what we would expect everywhere now, which actually is the case in India today. But it ran into majority opposition in the Parliament. And the Nehru government wouldn't back him. They realised that their political future was at stake. And he was deeply, deeply disillusioned. And what it emblematically showed him was that politics is not enough. constitutions are not enough, that we're going to see more about this later on, but that the real key issue is the state of mind generally within society. Constitutions are as good as the people. If only the Americans had thought of that before they went into Iraq, followed by us. Of course, his first concern was with his own people, the people from whom he'd come and for whom he was the great leader. It's something like, in India today, something like 200 million people are classified as belonging to the scheduled castes, which means they are on a schedule of the constitution. They would formerly have been considered untouchable. In many villages in rural India, they are still treated as untouchable. This is not just theory, I've seen it. I've seen what happens to people. Two cup system, just to give you a little example. They can't keep you out of a public restaurant, but they have two sets of cups, a glass one for everybody, and clay ones for Dalits, and they'll be broken after they've gone. So it's sort of, you know, apartheid and prejudices that we've had in this country and so forth, still have. But all writ large, institutionalised on a very, very solid basis. So he saw there was no possibility of changing that simply by constitutional means. So what he had to address was those people themselves. And he saw that the change had to be a change in their own mentality, their own outlook. They couldn't change how other people saw them, but they could change how they saw themselves and how they acted. And he thought of this as ultimately a religious question, in the sense that religion tells us about our place in the world. You could broaden that. Humanism is a kind of religion in that sense. But a perspective on what it is to be a human being, what it is to be alive, what the purpose and point of human society is. And he looked at world religion. He was apparently offered a very large sum of money by the Nizam of Hyderabad, a Muslim, but he refused it. He was courted by Christians, he was courted by Sikhs. But he himself had been deeply impressed by the Buddha from a very early age, and he came to the conclusion that Buddhism was the best religion for his people. He had various criteria. It had to be in tune with social principles, liberal social principles. What he talked of as liberty, equality and fraternity, which he said he didn't derive from the French Revolution, but from his master, the Buddha. So he saw them as deep, human, even spiritual principles. That modern religion, that religion for his people, had to be in conformity with science, by which I think he meant that it had to be reasonable, not asking people to believe things that are at odds with the evidence, you know, like that the world was created 4,000 years ago or whatever. So he settled on Buddhism. He considered that Buddhism was the best religion to give his people the changed attitude that they needed to claim for themselves a human position, a human space in Indian society. Claim for themselves. He had a big argument with Gandhi about this, because Gandhi said, you know, we high castes have been responsible for this problem, we've got to solve it. He said, you haven't solved it for 3,000 years, and anyway, that simply puts us in the same inferior position. We are going to sort this out. So he converted in 1956, and over the next months and years, what now amounts to 30 million people. That nobody really knows, because census officers often won't write down Buddhist in the census. They'll put Hindu if somebody says they're Buddhist. The thing that's so important that you should know is that the success of this conversion is statistically measurable. The 2001 census, Government of India census, shows quite a range of statistics that show that those who became Buddhists have improved themselves economically, socially, educationally, particularly, completely out of proportion to comparable castes who didn't convert. So many more of them have taken up education. Very striking that a very high proportion of girls have been educated, which is still a vast discrepancy between the education of girls in Indian society generally and boys. But the Buddhists have by and large given equal weight to their girls. Not quite, but by and large. I can't remember the ratio. They've taken advantage of affirmative action in Indian social policy, political policy. So there are many more Buddhist MPs, many more police chiefs, many more district commissioners who are administrators who fulfil the job of the British administration, and they are virtually God over 500,000 people. And I've got friends who are district commissioners in that way from a Buddhist background. There are Buddhist police chiefs. The chief secretary of Maharashtra state, which is one of the biggest and most wealthy states in India, is where Bombay is a Buddhist from that background. So the statistics show that they've modified their position. Another important statistic: in India, you know that there's a preference for boys, for having boys, for boy children. There's a large problem of female infanticide. So in most parts of India, there's a big imbalance. Well, statistically significant, very statistically significant discrepancy between girls and boys. And in the Buddhist community, it's nearer to normal. It's not completely at what it would be expected on, what's the word for it, on average grounds, as it were. But it's way different to comparable castes and communities. Even quite wealthy ones, like the Punjab is very bad for the sex discrepancy, where people are really quite wealthy. So it's had not just a measurable influence on people's social status and wealth and so forth, it's had an influence on their attitudes, their social attitudes, and their sense of decent behaviour. It's very, very striking going from Maharashtra, where I spend 6 months every year in India in this work, and when you go from my friends in Maharashtra, I've got many women friends. They feel quite free to talk with me. Women are much freer in Buddhist society in Maharashtra. Not completely. There's still a sexual discrepancy between the genders, but much freer than it would have been even 20 years ago when I first went there. You go up to northern India, you hardly see a woman. I remember giving a talk in Rajasthan. There are probably 200 people in the audience, a small audience, and it's all men. And halfway through my talk, three figures came in at the back, and they were women, and they had their saris over their heads, completely covering their faces. They sat at the back for 10 minutes, then got up and walked out. And it's not so bad everywhere, but it's quite commonly my experience. But in amongst Buddhists in Maharashtra, where its main conversions have taken place, there's a real change in family relations and the value that is given to each individual. It's not perfect, just as it isn't at the LBC, but it's a big measurable change from what was there before and what is there outside that community. So the question is, why? Why did becoming a Buddhist make a difference. Such a measurable difference, one that is noted by other communities. You know, I've had people from the dominant caste in Maharashtra, the Maratha caste, which is the politically dominant caste. I've had people from that section of society, well, we've noticed what's happened to the Buddhists, and we want a bit of that. They don't seem to be willing to follow through the thinking there, but that's another question. Although some do. A very, very good book on the Buddha, written by a Maratha leader. So why does Buddhism make a difference? Is it just conversion in general? Or is it Dr. Ambedkar's influence? But he's influential right the way through India. His picture will be up in the homes of 20, 30 million people, 40, 50 million people. I've seen it everywhere. There's a statue of Dr. Ambedkar everywhere. And people do espouse Dr. Ambedkar's political message. But only in a few places outside Maharashtra have people followed him into Buddhism. And even there you see a big difference between Buddhist Ambedkarites and non-Buddhist. So what's the difference? This is something for us to really reflect upon, because often people get a bit snooty about these mass conversions in India. You know, we like to think we're real individuals and what we've done is a sort of very personal act, and that you think of 400,000 people all converting together, no idea what they're doing really, but just in faith in Dr. Ambedkar, you think, well, you know, we're beyond all that. But actually similar things have to happen with us too. I don't mean mass conversion. I'll just throw that out and I'll try and work out what I meant later. Oh my goodness, I've not even got to the beginning of my story. So, what makes the difference? Well, you could say the real essential difference is karma. What Buddhism teaches you is that you are responsible. It's your life. You're not responsible for what's happened to you. The fact that you were born into an untouchable community, you can't be blamed for. Under the orthodox Hindu perspective, yes, it's your fault. But you can't be blamed for that. It's a social issue. It's a socially constructed notion. It doesn't have any reality. So you can't be blamed for that. You can't be blamed for being poor. But you are not the victim of that. You don't have to remain the victim of that. You can do something about it. You can do something about it in a very practical sense. You can struggle. You can fight for your rights. You can agitate. You can use the political means that modern Indian democracy gives you. You can use the legal system. Dr. Ambedkar had a famous slogan, which was educate, agitate, organise. It's a pretty fundamental ingredients of a social struggle. So get yourself educated, get out of ignorance. You know, I've seen older Buddhists who were illiterate, who've starved themselves to get their children an education, gone without food so their children would get an education, and their children have become district commissioners, police chiefs, and so on. So, yes, it does mean that you will struggle to fight for a better life in a straightforward political sense. But it's something more than that, because it isn't. What karma teaches you is that what the struggle consists in is a moral struggle. You're struggling for dignity. That's what Dr. Ambedkar said. We're struggling for human dignity. Our fight is a fight for human dignity, for the human soul, poetically speaking. We're fighting to create for ourselves a true human life, an ethical life, in which we act decently, like decent human beings. Whatever anybody else may do, whatever anybody else may say, we can act well. And if you do act well, according to the law of karma, things change. You change. You become a more substantial person. You become a more effective person. You're able to take advantage of openings that do occur. You're able to combine with others in a constructive way. One of the major things that Dr. Ambedkar gave modern India is a peaceful revolution. I don't know whether you know this, but in India today, there's a serious issue of Maoist insurgency. It's very little known outside India. It's a very serious issue. At its height, I think about a third of the districts of India were subject to some degree of so-called Naxalite incursion. And I've seen it myself. I've not been allowed into areas because the Naxalites were operative there. It's very, very serious. And they're mainly working with tribal people who live in the forests, the Naxalites, and who have no rights, who modern commercial exploitation is depriving of their traditional livelihoods. Dr. Ambedkar saved India from that, because really, for many people in India, the social oppression is so bad that violence really does seem the only alternative. I've seen people just almost mad with desperation talking about what they've had to suffer. The Dhamma, at this very basic level of karma, teaches you a way of improving the situation for yourself and for others slowly, but very effectively, which results in this measurable statistical change. Buddhists have a very strong idea of dignity. It's very, very important to them to act in a respect-worthy way. And it's very important to them to be socially aware and to act within society in a constructive way. There are many limitations to this and much that one could criticise, but on a mass scale it's been remarkably successful. So this is the first thing I want to draw your attention to, that the Dhamma teaches people in a very basic way personal responsibility. It tells you you're a human being, equal to everybody else, that you have the same possibilities as everybody else as a human being, that the opening up of those possibilities is not entirely in your hands, of course. You need help, often. But whatever help you get, whether you get it or not, you can lift yourself up. Just by being a decent human being, by taking advantage of whatever opportunities there are to improve yourself through education, by taking advantage of political openings, and so on. Very, very inspiring indeed, even though there's so many limitations to it. I'd say that when I first went there in 1985, that the experience of that, Sri Ratna was there on that occasion, it just changed my life. I, for the first time, saw that what I was engaged with wasn't just an outflow of the hippie 60s, and good for me, as it were, and replacing, in a probably more skillful way, LSD and so forth. But that it had real implications for, well, the injustice that there is in the world. And I've had recently another taste of this, on a much smaller scale, but for me, in a sense, even more exciting, because I'm seeing it right at the beginning. It's amongst Roma in Hungary. I made a connection with... I talked about this last time, didn't I? I'll go on and on talking about it, because it's so exciting. I made contact, for obscure reasons, in the way that one does, when I managed to get my email through their spam filter. I made contact with a group of Roma who were inspired by Dr. Ambedkar. Very strange, distant echo of India, because of course, ancestrally, many of them derive from India, and 10% of Roma in Hungary speak a language that's quite close to Hindi, actually even closer to Gujarati. They've no recollection of this, no feeling for it. But some of them realise that Dr. Ambedkar's way of understanding social development really suited them, really fitted their situation. And so I've been going there, and I managed to arrange for some of them to come to India. And they became mitras, connected with our order. And they've started a number of schools in northern Hungary, in an area where 95% of gypsies are, they don't mind themselves, they like to call themselves gypsies, are unemployed, where most have no education at all because they're excluded, either subtly or not so subtly. And they've started schools which are run in a way that suits Roma youngsters who wouldn't feel comfortable in a normal school and wouldn't be welcome, really. And so they're slowly turning out high school graduates, they're turning out people who are getting on to university. And it's very much at this level of just realising it's your karma. They're not Buddhists, that, you know, our immediate friends are. Many of them are not Buddhists. But they're strongly influenced by a Buddhist attitude coming from our mitras. This attitude, it's your life, take control of it. Educate yourself, make yourself. What you do will affect your future. It'll affect how you feel. And very slowly over the 6 years I've been going, I've seen that affecting, especially young people. Some very, very moving encounters. One of the most extraordinary experiences I had, I went 3 years ago, I think it was, and I was asked to make a presentation to a women's group from the Roma slum, a ghetto actually, right on the edge of the village. There's a complete change in paving, lighting, water, sewage, etc. And anyway, they wanted to know something about India and what was happening there. They're quite fascinated, especially because when they see Indians, they just see themselves, not just from the faces, but from the situation. So these very, very rough, you know, they're battered by life and often looking as if they're, you know, 70 when they're 40. They're quite literally. The one woman wearing a really quite sort of fashionable knitted dress. And I said, I really admire your dress. And she said, yeah, I picked it up in the street in the neighbouring town. And mostly living with scavenged clothes. Anyway, I showed them, you know, the usual slideshow of the work that's happening in the Bombay slums, our Buddhist work in the Bombay slums, where we're helping, especially women, to create a more positive atmosphere in their houses. Puttali work, this is really wonderful work, and especially trying to tackle alcoholism, which is the blight of the poor everywhere, because it drowns your sorrows for a bit. And also helping them to deal with moneylenders in the Bombay slums. Moneylenders can charge up to 300% a month, and it's exactly the same in Roma settlements. Really huge quantities. It happens here. Okay, I didn't know that. I must say I'm always conscious that there's a lot going on here that echoes all this. We must keep that in mind. It's easier to see it over there. And they just were very, very excited. And some of them were saying, you know, just straight out, you know, is this Buddhism that's done this for these people? One woman said, you know, I've been a Catholic all my life, but they never cared about me. You know, they don't even let us in the church. If we have a wedding, we have it in the porch. And she said, you know, I think we should try a bit of this. And what they're just looking at is Buddhism at the most basic level. Just take responsibility for yourself, which is what we all need to do, actually. We might think we're beyond that, but we need to start there. We need to take responsibility for ourselves. There are actually other forms of exclusion and isolation, etc., that happen amongst us in all sorts of ways, not just social or racial prejudices or whatever, but also mental illness and so forth, all of which isolate and exclude people. And people need to be encouraged to take responsibility responsibility for themselves, just as we need to take more responsibility for ourselves to get our feet on the path. So maybe I've made that point at greater length than I intended, but I get so inspired by this area of work. And I think I'm not going to try to squeeze in the other two points I was going to make. I'll go on to talk about them tomorrow. But they connect, well, the next point connects very directly with this. Because, of course, you can be tackling the, or rather giving the people who suffer within society and within the economy in various ways the tools to take responsibility for themselves, a very basic outlook to take responsibility for themselves. But what about the setup? What about the system? What about the attitudes that, you know, in the village where we're mainly working, Shayukaja, you know, there's the political party in power is Fidesz, which is a right-wing conservative party, strong nationalist overtones, very closely connected with an outright fascist organisation, Jobbik. And you know, what can we do to help people out of that? Because presumably that those sort of attitudes come from cultural inheritances of various kinds, from ideas that they're inheriting, and also from various kinds of suffering. So what can we do to reach across the divide and try to alter cultural attitudes much more broadly? What can we do to change attitudes everywhere? What can we do to change attitudes in Britain? So that people do live more in accordance with karma. So I'll start there tomorrow and begin to look more at how our task is really the once we've really addressed those who immediately need help. There are lots of them, and even here around us. Not necessarily overtly Buddhist help, but a Buddhist message, if you see what I mean. How, after that, are we to address the wider issues in society? How are we to inject a different outlook, a different perspective? We've really done so little so far. You know, it's not surprising, really. It's a big, big work. First of all, we've had to create something of a community. And we're still building. We're still building that. But I think that Buddhism really needs to come of age and begin to reach out more deeply into society. We used to talk about this a lot. We used to think about it a lot. But we really just didn't have enough. It was, you know, like somebody who hadn't done any weight training trying to lift weights, thank you, yes. Trying to do a marathon without having done any training. We've been sort of preparing ourselves, but I really think that we're in a position to be much more active in addressing fundamental attitudes around us. And we will not be unheard, if you like. There are many people who are dissatisfied with the current state of things. It's very obvious from recent events, isn't it? The Occupy movement, for instance, in Kuwait, and multi-voiced as it was, it represented a strong feeling that the system is wrong and something better is needed. So I want to talk tomorrow as quickly as I can. I'll try to hold myself back from recapitulating everything about the remarkable work of Dr. Ambedkar and the work that we're beginning in Hungary, to talk and think about that. I should say that I think there is work being done here that is equivalent to that, but I would like us to do more. I'd like us to do much more to address the various kinds of ghetto in British society. Many housing estates all over Britain of many different cultural constitutions are pretty bleak, and there's very little outlook for people. We need to be addressing that. We need to be addressing people who probably wouldn't go near anything Buddhist, but would appreciate a message of encouragement to take stock of oneself and live a decent life. So I think it's a larger discussion to be had in our Tri Ratna Buddhist community and even at the London Buddhist Centre. What can we do to reach out, yes, to major oppression overseas, but to the various forms of exclusion, oppression, traps that people get into, cultural traps that people get into, and help them to break out. Difficult work, but I think it's something that it's hard to really develop your own mind in a compassionate way and ignore. So I'll leave it there. We'll come back. I'll try to get fairly smartly down to it. I always get distracted by my recapitulations and seeing new things as I speak. So I'll try to come fairly smartly into that. Yesterday's talk, if you want to catch up, was on the is on Free Buddhist Audio, and also there's a paper that these talks are based on, available in the foyer now, with your ice cream. So see you tomorrow.